Well, this is probably my favorite story of the Old Testament. And I thought it would be fun to sort of act it out. It really is a drama with three characters and a narrator. So I want to thank our participants. And did it take you a moment to figure out who was being the voice of the Lord? That was part of the plan. I don't think that there is a minister or a religious leader of any stripe who hasn't felt exactly the way Samuel felt. God called him to be judge over the people of Israel. He had tried hard to fulfill that calling the best way he could, and he had served for many years. But Samuel was getting old, and his sons were lacking in the character and traits required to succeed him. So the people began their lament. We want a king. Now, Helen did a great job of reading the part of the people, but one voice doesn't quite capture the magnitude of the moment. It wasn't just one fussy person or a few people. It was all of the leaders of Israel. So let's do it now in a more realistic manner. All of you together now say, we want a king. Ready? Here we go.
We want a king.
Now, let's do it a little bit more convincingly. We want a king. All right. Samuel was displeased. Now, I checked a bunch of other translations to see if there were any other descriptions of his reaction, and they all used the same word, displeased. From a human perspective, I think Samuel's reaction was probably stronger than merely displeased. I think he was hurt. And hurt and anger, for me, and probably also for you, are two edges of the same sword. The Bible says that Samuel prayed to the Lord, but it doesn't record the words of his prayer. Now, based upon my guess about how Samuel felt, and also the Lord's response, I think Samuel's prayer went something like this. Lord, I just had the whole group of elders come storming into my office with a new demand. I was caught completely off guard. You won't believe what they want now. They want a king. Have I not been enough for them all these years? Have I not given myself totally to them, been at their beck and call, responding to their every whim and petty complaint? Have I not lost sleep, worrying about them, praying for them, trying to figure out answers to all of their problems? Have I not wept with them and felt their pain when they were suffering? Have I not given them my best wisdom and advice, settled their squabbles between them, and given fair judgments in all of the legal matters they brought before me? After all I have done for them, they reject me. What am I, chopped liver? They think a king would do a better job. Bah! Well, I don't think that there's a pastor or religious leader anywhere who hasn't gone to the Lord with a similar prayer. I know I have. But I probably used stronger language, including some words that ministers aren't supposed to say. The Lord's words for Samuel have been a comforting balm to me on many occasions. What the Lord said to Samuel was, "Don't feel bad. They have not rejected you, they have rejected me. They are only doing to you the same thing they have done to me since the day I brought them out of the land of Egypt, forsaking me and serving other gods." Now, the Lord's answer to the people employs a warning that we would describe as, "Be careful what you ask for." Samuel tells them what they can expect from a king. He will take your sons for his soldiers. He will command huge armies to serve him. He will make them plow his fields and harvest his crops. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take your best fields and give them to his buddies. He will take all of your slaves. He will take all of your best livestock. And you will be slaves to the king. Now, notice in this warning about kings, the Lord uses the verb take five times. Now, what comes next is one of my favorite parts. It is the great I told you so moment. Samuel predicts that one day they will cry out to the Lord because of the king that they demanded, but the Lord won't answer. The people would not listen to Samuel and continued to demand a king. So why, we might ask, did Israel want a king so badly, and why were those reasons so displeasing to God? Well, first of all, they wanted a king to be like other nations. God had chosen Israel to be a nation apart, God's own chosen nation and people. They were supposed to be different, but now they wanted to be like all the other nations. Well, it's a common thing for teenagers to want to wear the same style of clothing, to have the same brand of sneakers, and to be allowed to do all of the things that their friends are allowed to do. When I was a teenager, I wanted badly to get my ears pierced. Now, my mother's response worked then, but it would not work on a teenager today. She said I could get my ears pierced if I got my nose pierced. We expect children and teenagers to want to be like their friends, but mature adults should be past this. Now, secondly, they wanted a king to go out before us. In other words, they wanted a king to protect them, to stand between them and his enemies. And again, they wanted to be like children, wanting to hide in the safe folds of their mother's skirts. This was also an outright dismissal of everything that God had already done for them, including leading them out of Egypt and protecting them from their enemies. And thirdly, they wanted a king to fight their battles for them. A child who is being bullied and abused needs their parents and other adults to stand up for them and to put a stop to whatever or whoever is harming their child. Adults sometimes also need help and support, but not in the same way. There are many resources to help us fight the battles we face, but ultimately, as adults, we must take responsibility for ourselves and make the choice to change our own lives. Now, all of these reasons why the Israelites wanted a king were, as a British friend of mine would say, a bit wobbly. Their wanting a king amounted to a rejection of God as their sovereign leader. In spite of being warned about all the ways in which the king would be a taker, abuse his power, and exploit the people, they were learning to trust, they were willing to turn their trust away from a loving and benevolent God and become subjects of a selfish and self-serving mortal king. So let's change gears for a moment. How many of you noticed the title of my sermon? The Problem with Kings. And if you did, you probably said to yourself, uh-oh, she's not going there, is she? And I got that reaction from several of my friends and clergy colleagues. Today, the word king is politically motivated, and ministers are not supposed to get political from the pulpit. This Sunday, being the last Sunday in Pentecost and also the last Sunday in the liturgical year, is called Christ the King. Our country was founded by people who were trying to escape religious oppression and the rule of a king. I don't know that much about King George III, who was the English king during that colonial period. My quick research indicates that he was guilty of many of the same characteristics that the Lord, through Samuel, warned the people of Israel about. Throughout history and in many, many countries of the world, there have been good kings and bad kings, good queens and bad queens, good presidents and bad presidents. Throughout history and even today to some extent, one of the problems with kings and queens was the belief that they ruled by divine right. They and the people believed that God had put the king or queen in power, and therefore he or she had the right to govern as God's anointed. Now, we know that this especially caused problems when one sovereign mandated that a certain religion be practiced, but the next sovereign demanded that a different religion be practiced. People could and were put to death because they held worship services using the wrong prayer book. Now, one of the most important guiding principles of our faith as Presbyterians is that God alone is Lord of the conscience. I'm going to repeat it again because I want you to remember it. God alone is Lord of the conscience. Now I want you to say it with me. God alone is Lord of the conscience. Now this means that no one has the right to tell another person what they must believe. It is one of the great mysteries of our Christian faith that two people who are truly devout, who love the Lord with all their heart, and earnestly desire to follow biblical teachings, may in fact have different beliefs on many subjects, including politics. And I suspect that is true even within this congregation. Yes, we should, as Christians, follow Jesus as our King, before any earthly ruler or government. And we are lucky in our country because religious beliefs are respected and cannot be regulated by law. When one religion, or even a subset of one religion, attempts to usurp and undermine that freedom by making their beliefs the law of the land, this goes against what we believe as Christians and as Presbyterians. And it should also go against what we believe as Americans. If we follow Jesus as our King, we must still take into account that other people who also say that they follow Jesus as their King may see things very differently than we do. And even if we are absolutely firm and resolute in our belief that we are right and they are wrong, we do not have the right to mandate that other people bend their will and their conviction to ours. And of course, vice versa. So let's repeat it again one more time. God alone, are you ready? God alone is Lord of the conscience. And if I see any of you around town during the week, I'm going to quiz you to see if you remember that. We know that there are people in our country and perhaps even sitting in our congregation who desperately want to make our country a theocracy. Some people and even some pastors will declare that one party is of God, the other party is of Satan. They say that if you are a Christian, you must vote for a certain candidate, not another. They say and firmly believe that one candidate is ordained and anointed by God and other candidates are not. Now, I hope that we all pray to ask God's guidance when we vote. But we must always remember that earthly leaders are only that, earthly leaders. The Bible says we should obey earthly rulers, but the bottom line is we must follow our own conscience. We cannot and should not try to force others to follow our conscience if their conscience guides them differently. And once again, of course, vice versa. We should not have to violate our own conscience or the dictates of our own faith to accommodate the faith and convictions of others. Now, if we believe that we want our society and our government to bend to the will of God, then we have to ask a question. Who's God? Even if we were to agree that it should be the Christian God, I ask you to imagine this. Let's put 10 Christians into a locked room with a tricky Bible passage and tell them that they cannot come out until they agree on the interpretation. Even if they were all people, all of them were people who said they take the Bible literally word for word, they would never agree and they would never be able to come out of that room. They would all die there in that room. Now, this is one reason among many why I absolutely believe in the separation of church and state. Many people bemoan that prayers were removed from public schools. That happened when I was in the fifth grade. And probably a lot of you would like to see them return. But I have a question. Whose prayer? A Christian prayer? A Muslim prayer? A Hindu prayer? A Buddhist prayer? Even a Satanist prayer? If one is allowed, then all must be allowed. I would remind us all that Jesus encouraged prayer as a private expression of faith, not something we should make a show of. He said we should pray in a closet, not on a street corner. Anyone of any faith can pray at any time they want to, however they want to, silently, privately, and unobtrusively. It has been said that as long as there are algebra tests, there will be prayer in schools. And I can attest to this personally because it took me 2 years to get through Algebra 1. And I sailed through geometry, had no trouble with geometry. But it took me a year plus summer school plus another semester to get through Algebra 2. I'm not lying. As much as possible, we should try to find common ground, tend to our own business, and live peacefully with each other. The words of a hymn that was popular in the 60s still hold true today. They'll know we are Christians by our love. Who said that? Hazel said that. Okay. And in the 1990s, we were reminded to ask ourselves, what would Jesus do? We have only to read the Gospels to know that Jesus taught love and kindness and acceptance. He taught us to welcome strangers, to feed the hungry, to show compassion towards people who have been left out by society. He said that whenever we provide food for the hungry, drink for the thirsty, and invite the stranger, clothe the naked, or visit those who are sick or in prison, it is the same as doing it to him. And this is what it means to serve Jesus as our King. Or as it says in the Old Testament, to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. Thanks be to God.